This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
It's time now for me to welcome Professor Alison Wolfe. Alison is the Sir Roy Griffiths Professor of Public Sector Management at the School of Social Science and Public Policy at King's College London. She specialises in the relationship between education and the labour market and has a particular interest in training and skills, in universities and in the medical workforce. She's also very well known for her intellectual leadership in the field of educational assessment. Alison's no stranger to Cambridge Assessment, and she was actually a keynote speaker at our very first conference back in 2005. Okay, so may I introduce Professor Alison Wolfe.
Thank you very much. I was actually quite grateful to Cambridge Assessment, to Simon and Tim, when they asked me to give this keynote, because it's this usual principle, you know, if you want to learn about something, commit yourself to teaching it. If you want to, sort out your thoughts on it, agree to do a lecture on it. And what I'm going to do this afternoon is actually start at quite a theoretical level, and sort of in that sense stay in my comfort zone, since I teach public sector management, and therefore several times a year, and particularly in the last couple of weeks with new students, I get up and justify the role of the state. But I'm then going to move much more to where we are today in this country and to the extreme peculiarity of our arrangements, the continuing extreme peculiarity, and I would have to say, in my view, unfitness for purpose of the way that we currently intervene at state level in educational assessment. And I am in fact going to suggest that at the moment, although there is a certain tendency, perhaps a tendency born of desperation, to feel that the advent of Ofqual is a new dawn, that we are finally going to get to light touch regulation, unfortunately, and this is, I have to say at the very beginning, nothing to do with the people who currently run Ofqual, for whom I have the most enormous admiration. But I think that at the moment we are deluding ourselves if we think that things are going to get, from my perspective, and I think from many people's perspective, better. We are in fact continuing to compound the extreme peculiarity of our system and to move further and further away from what is the standard interpretation of the state's role in intervening in activities which could be perfectly well carried out by civil society. So what justifies government activity? Well, basically, government is there to do things that wouldn't happen at all if government wasn't there, and to do things that would not happen adequately in government's absence. This, of course, if you are an ambitious government, leaves you a large amount of wriggle room. But there has been a great deal of thought devoted to this over the years, and to what sorts of things might most necessarily be carried out by governmental agencies. And there are three things in particular which have been around for a long time. One is the idea of protecting common goods, the common land, fisheries, the air, atmosphere. It's hard to imagine we're going to do very much about climate change with government. It's very clear that we're not going to do anything very much about climate change without government. And equally, in terms of air pollution, where actually cleaner air has certainly made us all live longer, that's a classic governmental activity. And then there's also the idea of providing public goods, goods that no market can provide effectively because they can't be charged for effectively. So, you know, it's very hard to have an army that only protects you if you've actually paid your army tax. You know, you can try, but and equally, you know, when, if the fire engine comes, you don't really want them to be sort of trying to log onto the database to find out how many of your children you paid to have rescued. So there are public goods that basically all governments provide because nobody else can, and because, in effect, you can't charge. And there's another fundamental thing which we now feel government should do, which is actually very modern and which I will come back to later, which is that they should prevent and regulate monopolies. That actually one of the things that governments are there for is to ensure that there is, for example, a market. And this is actually rather new. In the past, the state thought that monopolies were a great thing and you sold them off and then that was what That was what monopolies were for. They were revenue raisers. Now we tend to think they are bad things and the government should regulate and control them. But going back to public goods, the traditional list includes one in the middle, which I have called weights and measures. And that is a very, very, very traditional role. And Cambridge, like pretty much any town in the world, actually, of any size, has a marketplace. And many people, myself included, think that civilization came out of trading and that, you know, that's how we got towns and cities, and towns and cities are the fount of pretty much all that's interesting in life. But they are certainly an activity. The activity of trading, the running of markets, the having of markets, is something which has been around for all of, certainly not merely all of agricultural humanity's history, but even before that, when there were hunting bands, they traded, and with the settled agricultural settlements, there came settled markets. And these were and are regulated by any government. Now, I'm going to come back to this in a minute, because what I'm going to argue today is that qualifications need to be thought of, and assessment, formal assessment needs to be thought of, in terms of that weights and measures function of government, of regulating markets in such a way that people are not cheated, that things are not sold at short weight, but that it's that very, very traditional role which is at the heart of the state's role in assessment, and which we have moved away from and no longer focus on in the way that we should. A little bit of history to this. Education and training are not traditionally public goods. If you look at most of history, the role of the state in education, in my educational assessment, was very, very small to non-existent. Most education took place in the home. Apprenticeships took place as private contracts between individuals and their apprenticeship masters. And the universities which first developed in Europe developed very much under the umbrella of and to serve the church, which itself was an institution as often opposed to as in collaboration with the state. So education and training were not, until very recently, state functions. They were not traditional state functions. They were not, until very recently, state functions at all. The state provided the underpinning of the system, just as it does for anything, pretty much in the same way as, you know, it provides weights and measures functions in marketplaces. Any economy needs the state to hold the ring, to provide a law of contract, so that if people don't hold their word, you can go to the courts, which were one of my public goods. And that was something which certainly underpinned the development of education. And in addition, through history, quite often the state did decide to give monopolies, to license. And it did that on two grounds. The overt ground was usually an extension, if you like, of the weights and measures function, that you couldn't trust people to operate unless they had been licensed, unless the state did something to make sure that only the competent practiced, that people might be cheated, and so there would be a monopolist, a licensing monopolist, so you could only be a hatter if you'd served a hatter's apprenticeship. And they were also, of course, a source of income, always, always a source of income for the state. And anybody who has read their Adam Smith will know that he railed against the monopolies introduced by and underwritten by the state, and particularly railed against old-style apprenticeships, which he thought were an obstacle to progress and a way of basically extracting monopoly profits from the population. So if you then start looking at the last 200 years leading up to today, you get two things happening which are to some degree very different. The first was the trend to economic liberalisation, an assault on monopolies, an assault on licences, an assault on barriers to trade and protection. That then had a reaction in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and we got central planning, manpower planning, big documents saying exactly how many engineers Sudan would need in 30 years' time, even larger documents predicting exactly how many technicians of various sorts either the USSR or India would need in 10 years' time. And in the UK, we did have a tendency to socialism like everybody else. There was a lot of nationalisation, stuff was later privatised. But actually in this country, the licence to practice, the determination to ensure that only people who had the right licence were allowed to pursue a trade, remained relatively rare. And then in the late 20th century, we get this re-embracing of the market. The state is the guarantor of competition, consumer rights, and also increasingly, and this is again going back to this weights and measures function in many ways, this idea that not only should the state guarantee competition, but it should make sure that consumers had information, that it should make sure that the scales were true, but it should also empower the consumer by giving them information about what it was that they were buying. But alongside that, and you know, equally importantly, we have the growth of the nation state and the growth of national and nationalized systems of education as a way of creating citizens with a common culture and identity. And I think it's very important to be aware of how much modern education and our idea of a national curriculum in a country is bound up with the growth of and the determination to create a sense of national identity. National curricula and the nation state go together very closely, as indeed do the nation state and compulsory education. And the more far-reaching the state, the less its tolerance for private education. And then alongside that, you get a growth of welfare services. It goes alongside greater wealth, it goes alongside democratisation, and the conviction that another thing that the state should be doing is redistributing, making sure that the wealth of the country is distributed more evenly, more fairly among its people, and that key services are free at the point of use, that there is absolutely a guarantee that you can get certain key welfare services, whether or not you have the savings to make up for them, to pay for them. And both these things are fundamental to the way we think about what government should do. So what does any of this imply for the state's role in education? Well, first of all, you get this idea that, all citizens should have an education that forms them as citizens. And this is why, if you want a subject which guarantees blood on the carpet, it's not maths, it's not science, it's history. History is the battleground in every curriculum development process that there has ever been. Not just here, actually we do reasonably well, but also here. So you want blood, go for history. Both ways. You also get some decent murderers, depending on who's won in the great curriculum battles. You also have, from the state, a commitment to equal opportunity in terms of access to education. And this is related to our concern that people should not be barred from or access or handicapped because of things that are beyond their control. So one of the things that all countries have moved to doing the minute they can afford it, pretty much, I think, I can't think of any exceptions, is to make schooling free for ever longer periods so that no child is disadvantaged by coming from a home where there is very little money or where there are parents who really don't think they should be educated. And by making available grants or, in our case now, increasingly income contingent loans, which are, again, not a particularly British idea, available to all citizens. And also ensuring that the gatekeepers who make decisions about what happens to people do so fairly and transparently. And that, above all, is really important in education. Are people selected for individual schools fairly? Do they get access to different forms of secondary education fairly? Do they get into university fairly? Are they able to go into the job market with a fair whack? Now, also in terms of the state's role in education, you have the idea that the state should actually provide education. This is much, much less universally accepted, and I would say actually much less universally accepted today than it would have been 40 years ago. Today we are much more inclined to feel that multiple providers can provide education as long as the state is ensuring that people have equal opportunity in terms of a call on resources. But it was the dominant pattern in early periods of universal education in many countries, although it's also true that when you sort of unpack this a little bit, you find the huge amount of apparently state education is actually still more or less church-based. And again, this is something that's familiar to us in this country. It seems extremely strange to Americans, but it's also a dominant pattern in a large part of Europe. So that's where we got to in terms of the modern state and education. But does any of this imply that it suddenly needs to be heavily involved in formal assessment processes and the furnishing of qualifications? I don't think it does. In fact, my answer is no, it doesn't. It does not follow. A country may decide that the state needs to be heavily involved in assessment. There is nothing in those functions of the modern state, nothing there in what it is that it needs to do in terms of opposing monopolies, ensuring free access, and indeed creating citizens, that says it needs to be heavily involved in the detailed day-to-day provision of qualifications and the way they are designed. That's where we are today in this country. We are out on a limb in the extent to which we are involved in this way. And it's very difficult, unless you step back and look at the rest of the world, to realise how very odd England is. A little bit more history, I'm afraid. Dominant patterns of provision in developed states, how the world works. Those of you who were in here earlier would have heard Tina Isaacs talking about curriculum versus qualification-based systems. I have to say, my perception of the world is that on balance, curriculum-based systems are far more common than those which are examination and qualification-led at all stages. That doesn't mean that there are many systems that have as few national qualifications or systems as the United States, which is also peculiar in its own way. But generally, globally, curriculum-based systems are far more common than those which are examination and qualification-led at all stages. And the dominant mode of formal accreditation for schools is high-stakes accreditation only at the end of upper secondary schooling, which is often but not always administered or tightly regulated by the state, plus in some countries some state involvement in certification at the end of lower secondary or compulsory schooling. So if you did a sort of a sample of, you know, what does the world do, that would be the dominant pattern. The other thing which I think is quite interesting, again, given where we are in England particularly today, is the pattern for vocational assessment, which is highly variable. It ranges from no formal awards to awards given by regulated organisations with no direct state oversight of the actual standards or exam content. And that is Germany, which has, of course, the most admired vocational system in the world, to freestanding state licensing exams in the US, to state-organized qualifications in France, which is closest to our pattern, but for the young in full-time and dedicated education programs. And there, even there, it combines teacher assessment of most of the vocational content with exam in general education. And direct state involvement is almost everywhere confined to vocational education training for the young, plus, and even here they don't tend to actually write the exams in most cases, some licensed occupations. And I would also like to point out in this context, given the fact that we are devoting in England such an enormous amount of time and effort to the minute oversight and design of qualifications, that the most valued certificates and qualifications of all throughout the world are those offered by universities. And this is not just because universities are top everywhere, if you like. The higher education system of the world is increasingly global. The degrees that are the most highly valued, if you look at the top lists, if you look, for example, at the Times top list, if you look at the ones that come out of Chinese universities, look at the ones published by American journals, the degrees of autonomous universities and systems which are not state-run are those which dominate the top of the league. So it's clearly possible in an environment where there are high stakes, highly informed consumers, lots of money in play, for qualifications to be issued which are top of the league in quality, respect, and what the world thinks of them, and which are issued by autonomous institutions. So it's not impossible. In general, when the state has a weights and measures function, it has taken care of it through the licensing and oversight of institutions. And that's particularly the case in terms of the education systems of the world. Mostly, they don't get involved in the minutiae of qualifications. They inspect, they regulate, they license institutions, and they let them get on with it. And the equal access issues are associated with a few high-stakes examinations relating to selection decisions and to gatekeeping at important points of transition. So, what I want to emphasise is our current English system is very peculiar indeed. It always has been. Qualifications have always been more important here, which I guess makes it very clear that you can get a lot of qualifications without government having to create them. If you go back to one of my very first slides, is government there because they wouldn't happen without it? Well, no, clearly not. We managed to create an enormous number of qualifications before government ever even noticed they were there. You can create qualifications without government. It's very easy to do so. We prove it. So qualifications became very important here in a country where actually government was relatively uninvolved early on. Again, this is English uniqueness in that we did a lot of things fairly early because we were the first country to industrialise. And we therefore developed organically, but based on institutions, multiple examination boards which provided academic exams for university entry and matriculation. We developed multiple vocational awarding bodies which developed from trade bodies and charities and so on. And as a result of this peculiar history, formal qualifications which developed organically became more important, especially, I would say, in vocational areas than in most countries. Our peculiarity was compounded post-war when the Labour government introduced individual subject certification. That's also very unusual in international terms. Most places have grouped awards, whether it's a high school diploma, a baccalaureate, an abitur, maturita, whatever. We used to have something like that. We got rid of it because the Labour government was actually convinced that it was important for people who might not be able to get the whole award to get certification in individual subjects. And throughout my lifetime, we keep trying to tear history up and recreate the old system. And Thomson was the last attempt at this. I mean, I think we should give up, actually. I think we should just live with A-levels and GCSEs and let them develop. But by now, we have this other peculiarity that we are a country which is utterly used to individual subject certification. But those also, apart from the fact that the Labour government introduced this, after that most of the development was taken forward by the individual exam boards. There was no national curriculum until the late 1980s, although the exam boards did create a de facto syllabus for middle and upper secondary pupils. And I know they created a de facto syllabus because otherwise the textbook manufacturers would have gone bankrupt, and there's always a symbiotic relationship between textbooks and syllabus. And anyway. And then we had the revolution. Now, I want to pause for a minute on this top left corner, because ever since then, as the whole way that that government gets involved in assessment has changed, and above all, as government's involvement in qualifications has changed, this has been, if you like, the mantra. In the 70s and in the 80s, Labour and Conservative politicians, and a large number of parents, I have to say, became very concerned about the quality of education in schools. And this started with Callaghan's Ruskin speech, which is called the Ruskin speech because he gave it at Ruskin College in Oxford, which is actually a remarkable institution which provides second chance education for people who come through the trade union movement, and then they can often do go on to Oxford from there. So Callaghan gave a speech at Ruskin College in which he was very concerned about what's now currently called, sort of thought of as progressive education. And then the Tories under Mrs. Thatcher were also concerned. There was the great scandal of Tyndale School, William Tyndale School in London, which hit all the papers and convinced everybody that there was a crisis in primary education. And then I think you should never give too little weight to Mrs. Thatcher's hairdresser. Mrs. Thatcher's hairdresser was not pleased with the primary education that his children were getting. Mrs. Thatcher's hairdresser told her this regularly, like every morning, and one of the results of that was the national curriculum and national testing. But the thing I want to emphasise here is that this had nothing whatsoever to do with qualifications. Nobody at this point was wandering around saying O-levels don't give the right answers. Nobody at this point was wandering around saying A-level standards have gone through the floor. There was no crisis associated with qualifications. None. The crisis was about the quality of basic education in primary schools, perceived crisis, actual crisis, whichever. It was not about qualifications. But what it did was it set government off on a path justified by a conviction that if it didn't get involved, education would fall apart, the major result of which was a complete takeover, a complete nationalisation of the qualification systems of this country. And that was a problem because we had so many of them. If we hadn't had very many of them, it probably wouldn't have mattered as much. But we did, and they did, and it was and it is. So what did we get? We got detailed supervision of, well, by this time, GCSEs. That was Keith Joseph's great reform. I happen to think it was a great reform, but that's another speech. Detailed supervision of A-levels. And at the same time, coming up on the outside, we had an infatuation with skills as a strategy for growth and productivity, which led to NVQs, which were supposed to provide standards and nationally standardized qualifications, which would absolutely revolutionised vocational education in the country, the efficiency of people moving through the labour market, and basically drive all other qualifications out because NVQs were so visibly superior. We, at the same time, were getting a growth in the new public management, in which, once again, this country has been a leader. Whether you think being a great leader in new public management is a good thing or a bad thing is open to argument, but it also added to what was happening. So we had the growth of accountability targets and public service agreements, which required departments to achieve measured outcomes. I actually have to say that I have a sort of, you know, mixed view of this. I think new public management and measured outcomes and targets are unfortunately sometimes good, sometimes bad. But I think in this case, they had a particular outcome which was extremely bad, and I'll come to that in a second. So anyway, along that side that, we had the public service agreements which required departments to achieve measured outcomes, and we had government measuring its own success publicly by how outcomes were achieved. And that's the killer. Government measured its own success by things which it increasingly tightly controlled. And at the same time, because we were in a qualification-driven system, and we were very much tied to this, and in fact increasingly tied to it because of all the effort being put into developing NVQs, and then later new vocational qualifications for full-time education, the need to count things, which is itself generated by the output culture, the league table culture, then creates another need for common measurement scales for all qualifications with levels and points attached to them. And once you start down the measured outcomes road, and once you start down the road which says, I am going to measure performance, and I, the government, am going to measure my performance in terms of those outcomes, you inescapably end up with the need for this common measurement scale. So the regulatory agencies come and go and increase in number, and I'm not going to spend hours on them with people in this room who know a great deal more about many of them than I do. But that's where we are now. Common measurement scales, outputs, targets, government measuring itself by it, and a qualification system which is more highly regulated, with regulation going far further into the adult population and encompassing a far greater number of qualifications than any other country on earth. So to repeat this, we are very peculiar. So is this still a weights and measures activity in any normal sense of the word? Is government basically just doing what it has always done in marketplaces, which is saying, are the scales true? Are you getting the measured quantity that you think you're getting? Are you being cheated by the people who are selling you and providing you with qualifications? Or have we gone beyond that to where, far from measuring the scales and ensuring that the quality is good and that we know what we're getting, government is deciding what should be stocked. You can only sell tomatoes. Oh, and you can have a few chestnuts on the side. It seems to me clear that we've definitely got to that point. We've got to the point where government is deciding what should be offered, what can be sold. And unfortunately, we've also been going even further than that in recent years. Government has not only been specifying what should be offered and what it should look like, it has also actually been going into production on its own behalf. So, you know, it's as though you've got this stock of vegetables, and most of them are still produced by regulated consumers, but somehow out there in the middle there's this new type of chard which has got a lot of government investment behind it, and you are going to eat it because it's good for you. So government's role has been transformed, and I think this is really the point. It isn't just concentrating on its traditional weights and measures function. It isn't just checking that qualifications give true weight, which in the past it did, and much of the world it can still do, even if these are other government, by basically regulating in the sense of checking that processes are right, that procedures are right, as indeed is the case in my own institution. We do not have each of our degrees accredited. The government regulates the institution, it checks the procedures, even that's quite new. I think it's not necessarily such a bad thing. But that is a weights and measures function. What is happening in non-university qualifications is no longer a weights and measures function. It's what's known as, in the trade, tight supervision at best, and in many key cases, direct production. So it's not just ensuring a common curriculum either. It is deeply in there as a supervisor and a producer on a scale which is unparalleled. Now, I've said it's peculiar, I've said it's unparalleled, I've said nobody else in the world does it. This activity assumes that government can be effective and impartial. Indeed, it implies that it is more effective, maybe more efficient and more impartial than independent bodies can ever be. That is the justification. The role of government is to do things which the market can't do better. It's to do things which generally civil society won't generate on its own. And the general assumption this is that you do it if you can do it, if government can do it better, because there are always downsides to it. Well, most of us are pretty unconvinced that it's being done very efficiently. And most of us are pretty unconvinced that it's being done very effectively. And, you know, if you look at think tank publications across the spectrum, if you even look at sort of, you know, politician speeches, criticism of the current complexity is, you know, this is bread and butter. You know, you churn it out, you say, of course, we're going to simplify it. It's not good, it needs to be simplified. So, you know, at some level, there's a consensus. That's one half of it. On the other side, I would like to suggest to you, public confidence in the examination system is at an all-time low. Actually, nobody believes in A-levels anymore. They maybe should, and if you're the minister, if you're Secretary of State for Education or you're the opposition, of course you give your regulation speeches and quite rightly about how kids have worked hard and so on and so forth. But given that the argument for this intensive state intervention was that the system couldn't cope on its own, that it was being undermined, that we were going into a crisis, that this was something where the current institutions weren't developing it, it is rather extraordinary that we are now in a situation where basically come August the A-level jokes get rolled out. And this is the thing which convinces me that we really have lost the confidence of the population. And that's the diploma. The diploma has had an enormous amount of money put behind it, really enormous. Institutions have been given large amounts, not merely of support, but of money to do it. And if you compare the uptake of the diploma with the uptake of the GNVQ, what is striking is that people just don't trust it this time round. That actually, if you look at kids and their parents, they don't believe that government is an honest producer of qualifications. any more than anybody actually believes that the standard of A-levels is the same as it was 20 years ago. It may or it may not be, but nobody believes it. And the, you know, just ludicrously tiny uptake for the diploma is what has convinced me that actually, in terms of creating confidence, not only have we not increased confidence in the qualification system, we have destroyed it. But wasn't that the bad old days? Doesn't Ofqual signal a move back to light regulation and emphasis on truthful product labelling? Well, I would love to think it did. And I do also absolutely accept that its present senior management and chief regulator are believers in light regulation and will do what they can to run things that way. But I have to say that the structures that they inherit, the structures they receive, the legislation that's currently going through Parliament is not going to make this easy for them. In fact, I'm willing to wager a large amount of money that if it goes through and remains the way it is, we will not get light regulation, we will not get a rolling back of tight control. We will actually get more control, more interference, and a further tightening of the screw on the nature, content, and direction of qualification structures. That's because of the way that the legislature... It is not, unfortunately, as I said, unfortunately not. This is not the end of the bad old days, not the way the current legislation proposes, not the way Ofqual is currently constituted, and not the way human people, beings behave. I want to just highlight two or three more things quickly. I said right back at the beginning when I was talking about the role of the states, which is my, you know, it's my bread and butter. That's what I do. I teach public sector management. I teach what the state should do. I do this. One of the things that the modern state is meant to do is to fight monopolies, to create competition, to make it easy for there to be new entry, to make it to have a level playing field. You know, that's what the whole single market of the EU is meant to be about. That's why there's this big fight at the moment over subsidies to Opal. You know, that's part of the role of the modern state. The danger with regulated industries always, and this is something that everybody recognises, anybody who's worked in any regulated industry, is regulatory capture. That you get, there's a mutual self-interest of regulators and established producers, as opposed to new entrants and innovators, but there's also the fact that regulation tends to reduce competition, so it's only justified when it's the lesser evil, because it makes it harder to enter. It reduces the responsiveness to multiple signals from the market if it is a competitive market. And at its most extreme, it creates monopolies. And I would suggest to you that the current structure for qualifications of this country is doing exactly that. It's actually making it incredibly difficult to create new qualifications and incredibly difficult to start as a new person, as a new organisation offering them. That actually, for better or worse, we have created a situation in which the large operators, however much they may hate the current situation, nonetheless have a stake in it, with apologies to my hosts, because they're in there. And it may drive them mad, but at least they're in there. Whereas actually, to create anything new, to have anybody new starting up, is very difficult. And the problems associated with creating a new qualification are just enormous. I mean, it takes forever. So you're not going to do it unless you're going to have a huge market or unless government's going to pay you. And what does that say? The other reason that I don't think that the new structure makes any major difference is that we are still in a situation where governments are measuring their own success by the performance of tightly supervised or tightly or nationalised agencies. And Charles Goodhart coined this law, and it is a law, and, you know, it's absolutely, you know, I defy anybody to find me corporate to counter examples, which says any measure used for control purposes is unreliable. In other words, if you control the measurement of the output and you are being judged by it and you are using it to hand out money and to give yourself a pat on the back, that outcome measure is going to become fallible. And it's not a question of if, it's a question of just how quickly. And we are still in a situation where government is controlling qualifications and judging its success and handing out points on the basis of outputs which it measures and controls. And nothing about the splitting off of Ofqual from QCA has changed that. The third reason why I think we still have a problem is that experience indicates that governments have little ability or incentive, and there are books on this, you know, so I will just say take this on trust, to take account of costs. I mean, that's not what governments do. It's not the way they're made. Why would they? They're not the ones who, they worry at some level about the total tax burden, but that's about it. And the other thing is that, and this is what I mean about human behaviour, public agencies, like any other body, like my department in my university, like an awarding body, any agency seeks to promote its own survival at the most minimal, its own importance, its power, its size. It wants to protect itself. It wants to make it difficult to get rid of it. For that reason, among others, if agencies are given powers, they will sooner or later use them. That's another law. If you give an agency a power, it will sooner or later use it. And entrepreneurial agencies, of which fortunately that's a subset, entrepreneurial agencies will build on their remit, be creative in suggesting the need for further action, and progressively extend their reach. I would like to offer as an example something which I apologise to our foreign visitors, but which I think everybody in the room apart from them will recognise. It's the case of Ofsted and the working mothers. Or to be exact, Ofsted and the two police women who were sharing childcare. Two police women who were sharing childcare were visited by an Ofsted inspector who informed them what they were doing was illegal, because they were looking after each other's children while they were working part-time, and they were not registered and inspected. And therefore, they had to stop doing it immediately. When I lived in the United States, to belong to a babysitting co-op. That would clearly have been illegal too. And if anyone wants to ask me to elaborate on this, I promise you, under Ofsted regulations, it was definitely illegal. Now, the Ofsted statement, when this hit the press, as it indeed it did, I don't know how quickly, I think it sort of pretty quickly, I think one thing was to say that they were, and they were quite right, following the legislation, that the 2006 Childcare Act said anyone in England looking after children for reward must be registered and inspected. Now, actually, Ofsted were quite right. If reward was only money, there are a lot of things that people are currently taxed on that they wouldn't be taxed on. You know, the revenue is quite clear. If you receive a car, that's a taxable reward. And so Ofsted's statement in September, when this first blew up, was reward is not just a case of money changing hands. By last week, when, if anybody's interested in the national response, I refer you to the BBC website, where they had to close for comments after 24 hours. by last week, when ministers had become very, very concerned to stop this, and were announcing that they had basically instructed Ofsted to change their interpretation, Ofsted was offering a rather different press release. Ofsted welcomes the moves to clarify the regulations. But actually, they were right. Local government surveillance powers is another one. There are now tens of thousands of requests made by local government to engage in surveillance of citizens to see whether they are putting their rubbish in other people's bins, living somewhere which is not the catchment area for their schools, and so on. The regulation of investigatory powers, according to Lord Maurice of Aberavon in the House of Lords in June, has been used in ways that were never intended as an umbrella for all sorts of activities by public organisations. It was categorically denied by the Home Office at the time that it would apply to local authorities. But it didn't say anything about local authorities not being able to apply. In fact, if you look at the legislation, it's perfectly clear that local authorities can apply, and local authorities do. So how might this apply to Ofqual? Well, what we have at the moment is we have a double whammy. We have a situation under the legislation that's going through where bodies can be regulated and qualifications can be accredited. And this is already two layers. If I again sort of refer you to the Chambers of Commerce who give out the qualifications for German apprenticeships, or if I refer you to any of our universities, we have one layer. We're regulated. We don't have the individual degrees or the individual called into the centre any more than an individual Chamber of Commerce in Germany has to send their exam papers into the federal government. So we've already got one more layer in regulation and accreditation. We also have reserve powers, which include the ability to call in any qualifications which a regulated body has not submitted for full accreditation. We also, in the legislation, have an additional layer which wasn't there before, which I don't want to spend ages on for those lucky people who don't know about it, which is guided learning hours, which is, again, something which we never had before, but which I submit to you does not sound to me like a rolling back of the regulatory state. And we also have something else. Because Ofqual is the inheritor and beneficiary of QCA's entrepreneurial activities. And I have been really surprised today by how accepting of the qualifications and credit framework everybody at this conference seems to be. I find it a truly extraordinary creation. There is nothing in legislation about the qualifications and credit framework that I've been able to find. As I go around Whitehall and Westminster, nobody has ever heard of it. I mean, literally, including people who are working on education, including really senior people. I'm not talking about civil servants. If you talk to politicians, if you talk to people in think tanks, if you talk to journalists, if you talk to commentators, if you talk to just about anybody, they have never heard of this thing. And yet it is an absolutely, enormously ambitious undertaking, which was set up by QCA without any statutory requirement, and which, as I said, as far as I can see, continues to have no statutory basis. And I would like, with great thanks to the AAT for allowing me to quote them, to just refer to what they've said about it. They are a relatively small, successful awarding body, which has very few qualifications. Their view has been that it has imposed a significant administrative and financial burden with no obvious benefit to students or employers. And they have also worked out, with detailed breakdowns, that between 2008 and 2010, for their very small number of qualifications, they are going to have to spend effectively £600,000 reworking those to fit with the qualifications and credit framework, without which they will not get recognition as a regulated awarding body, let alone accreditation of their qualifications. Now, this is the sort of thing that I mean. This is a framework which is non-statutory, highly restrictive, creates strong disincentives to innovate, is extremely expensive to implement, and is justified on two grounds. It's justified publicly on the grounds that without all of this, somehow the population of this country is going to have imposed on it dreadful qualifications. It will suddenly wake up one morning and find it's taken qualifications which have no value, no credibility, are dreadful. And therefore, we've got to have all of this because of this terrible danger which we only just escaped at the time that, you know, I don't know when, when NCVQ was set up, perhaps. And it's also valuable, and this is the thing which really shocked me, when I hear people promoting it. Do you know what they promoted, or the way they promote it? They say, it's great. You take these units and you can put them towards several qualifications. Do you realise how many more qualifications we'll be able to deliver once we've got this? And I can see the stars in senior civil servants' eyes. Look at that. Look at that as a way of measuring how successful we have been. So I'm afraid my view is that we have gone well beyond what the state's role should be in assessment. There are two things that we have a right to do as a state, a real role. One is related to the national curriculum and making sure that the national curriculum is delivered and assessed by schools, and that can be quite informal, as it is in most of the world. And the second thing we do have is we have a weights and measures function which the state has to carry out. But in my view, it has gone well beyond that, and in doing so has destroyed its ability to do the thing it was supposed to do. The weights and measures function cannot be carried out effectively by an institution which is itself producing the thing it is supposed to be measuring. The government has moved beyond being an inspector to being a producer, and it therefore cannot be an honest inspector anymore. The state should be reducing monopolies and cartels. It is actually creating barriers to innovation. The state should justifiably have broad educational aims, but we already have a national curriculum. So in my view, we need to backpedal very fast and restore a marketplace and qualifications in which the state has its genuine core role and no other. And I would like to finish with a picture of my very favourite market, which just shows that I'm a metropolitan creature. That's Borough Market. And Borough Market is a monument to what you can do when you have light regulation and a weights and measures function. It is a huge success. It has new things every week. Nobody gets poisoned, and it is heaving with clients. And it is in every guidebook to London. Thank you.
Alison, thank you very much indeed. We do have some time for a few questions, and I see there's a hand up there already.
Sorry, Alison, about our market. They're knocking part of it down.
I know they are. They are. It's a huge fight for Cross. It's because of Crossrail. I'm a bit torn on this. I think government has a role in infrastructure too. I don't think people make it escape. I don't know whether I should go back to slideshow or just leave you with that.
Isabel.
Thank you very much. I'm Isabel Nisbet from Ofcom. Thank you very much for a very stimulating lecture. I just wanted to throw in a few reasons why I'm not suggesting Ofqual is a great new dawn, but it might be at least a speck of light on the horizon. One is that the lessons of regulation over even the past 18 months seem to me to be that both light touch and crawling over the detail have been thoroughly discredited. And we can all learn from the expertise of versatile regulation, which is going in either in detail or standing back, depending on the need. But the other thing is that the economic realities of the time, of the first 4 or 5 years at least of Ofqual, will force us to prioritise. There is no, I mean, the absolute reality of it, I have a core budget just now of about 17.5 million. There is no way I'll get 17.5 million next year, whatever the bill says. And so whatever, we've got to do the best we can. We'll have to say, where is the added value from regulation? And when it's not there, even if we've done 10 monitoring studies for the last 50 years, we'll have to stop doing them to do what's most important. We've no choice in the matter because that's the economy that we're in. And the last point, I think, is your point, which is that both the government and the QCA have become completely, both emotionally, financially and personally involved in the creation of new systems and new systems like the QCF and new qualifications like the diploma. So that surely suggests that it's better to have an independent body that can at least stand back without all the baggage, oh, we invented this, to say, are you sure that's fair to the... Because even if you don't like the diploma or others don't, there's poor candidates there who are doing their best, some of them doing very well, and need to have a fair go. So there needs to be somebody who's a little bit detached from those who've got such baggage in it to say, just a minute, and also to try and see a fair playing field between those qualifications which have been invented by the government and those which haven't.
Isabel, I don't disagree with any of that. And when I said at the beginning that I really, none of this was intended to be critical of the current leadership of Ofqual, which I really, really, really meant it. I think that's all true, that it's a bit depressing that we have to rely on budget budget constraints to save us. I think, you know, the bit of the lecture that I didn't give because everybody would have gone, you know, completely crazy, I'd have been up here for far too long, is what should a regulator be like? I think that we should have some form of regulator. I don't believe there isn't a weights and measures function. I just think that the legislation that they have written for you is misconceived in key ways. And I basically, being in this area, a pessimist by experience rather than by nature, would be much happier if by the time we come out of the recession, somebody has rethought your statutes.
On many occasions questioned ministers about legislation and, you know, people responsible for creating legislation. They say they want this power, but they don't want to use it. And the question is there, well, if you don't want, if you don't plan to use it, why are you giving yourself
exactly.
It? Could you just briefly give me an idiot's guide to what it is that you think is in the legislation that shouldn't be there with regard to...
Okay, well, basically, what if you want to email me later, I'll give you a long list of things, a rather longer list, but just if you just start with the objectives, they're incredibly far-reaching. They're meant to promote, you know, preserve standards across huge sort of loads of qualifications which are judged to be equivalent. I mean, I actually think right there one leaves reality. I mean, just right there one leaves reality on qualification and assessment standards. They're supposed to create public confidence where, you know, one has to say that the more you're trying to do everything, the more the experience of the last few years is that you will actually undermine public confidence by trying to do everything and by proclaiming things to be the case, which everybody can see are not the case. And there's also an awareness objective, which I don't really understand, actually. Isabel can probably explain to me what the awareness is over and above the public confidence, but I don't think it's advertising on behalf of the government. And an efficiency objective, which seems to me to be a very peculiar way round to look at things, because efficiency is not something you mandate. And basically, if you're trying to create something that's efficient, what you start by doing is you start by trying to work out what the minimum burden is, not by starting with a sort of an all-encompassing model of perfection in which everything fits everything else and everybody does everything. But I think that basically part of the problem is that it's partly that ministers are terrified. I think this is one of the reasons we get this form of legislation. I don't know. It's a combination of ministers are terrified, so they want to cover their backs, which means that they give reserve powers for every ghastly nightmare that they can think of that might end up in the press. And the combination of that plus the fact that we actually have an ability to put huge amounts of legislation through in our system means that we create legislation at a dramatic and terrifying rate. But I do think that we've also suffered dramatically in this country from having an extreme form of output and agreement-driven central government. The combination of centralisation, treasury powers, and quantitative outcome measures has, you know, been kind of, you know, it's the other side of the deluge.
We have time for one final question, so if it could be Greg. And Greg, if you could use the microphone, that'd be great, because it helps with note-taking.
Thank you. It's Greg Watson from OCR. In many other regulated markets, globalisation has tended to be one of the forces that's broken down the tendency towards some of the state activity that you've talked about here. Do you think that's likely in education?
Well, it's not obvious, is it? We live in a, looking at it from a university perspective. I mean, I work in an institution where, in my department, more than half the undergraduates starting this year, in my school, more than half the undergraduates starting this year, come from outside the EU, never mind the UK. You would think that this is a globalised system already. And obviously you're conscious that you export qualifications all over the world very successfully. I mean, we're both foreign currency earners, right? somehow or other, it doesn't seem to connect. And, of course, the danger is that what we are indeed creating is a dual system, the highly regulated state system and the unregulated parallel system, which is not what you want to create if you go back to sort of, you know, the equal access, equal opportunity duty, which I think lies on modern governments. So I used to think that globalization would achieve things that it doesn't always seem to. And I think that one of the things that there is always the danger that it creates is as I said, there's this bifurcated market between those who indeed live in a globalised environment and those who are kind of stuck.
Okay, well, it just remains for me then to say thank you very much, Alison, for a weighty and measured presentation with no state intervention.
We should rather measure a bit, Paul, but thank you very much, everyone.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.